This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Stephen Jones, director of the Washington State University Bread Lab. Stephen Jones is here to tell us about the work of the Bread Lab to breed and develop publicly available varieties of grains and other crops that will benefit farmers, processors, and end users while enhancing access to affordable and nutritious food for all members of our communities. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Why was the Bread Lab started?
First, I should say where we're located. So we're north of Seattle in Skagit County, and we work with growers in this region, and our region is basically west of the Cascades, the 19 counties west of the Cascade Mountain Range. And this is an area marked by small farms and diverse farms and farms basically at risk because we're all out of the big commodity systems here. So in our county, the average farm size is about 100 acres. The average farm size in the nation is about 1,000 acres. So we're small and diverse. And I should say, too, before I get too far into it, that 44% of the farmers in the state of Washington are west of the Cascade Mountains. So it's not a fact that's commonly put out there, but it's an important one. So we started the Bread Lab in 2008. We are part of Washington State University. We started it to add value to farmers' rotations where there was very little value. And I'll explain that by saying we work with potato farmers and seed producers and vegetable producers and tulip and daffodil growers. All of these folks need to grow grains in their rotation to improve the soil attributes, fight against disease and things like that. They have healthy rotations. So they rotate with wheat or barley or something like that. It's very good for everything except economically. So if you're a potato farmer or a tulip grower, when you get to wheat and barley in your rotation, there was very little interest from them. Dave Headland, a farmer here, said that he used to grow wheat for fun and sometimes profit. And that's not a very good business model. So we chose sort of the low end of a rotation scale to add value, to give farmers more value where there was very little. And the way we do that is to make wheat a non-commodity and give it some unique characteristics in terms of flavor and nutrition and things like that. And then sort of an added benefit is we're keeping value where it's actually produced. So if we grow wheat or barley north of Seattle, that wheat or barley can be malted here or milled and then baked or brewed or distilled into various products. And each time that you go through one of those loops, you add value and that value can stay here. So that's sort of the overriding theme of the Bread Lab.
Would you say a little bit more about the history of the Bread Lab?
Yes. So we're at a research station of Washington State University here in Skagit Valley, and there's never really been a breeding program for grains over on this part of the state. So we're plant breeders first, and again, we moved here in 2008 from the eastern part of the state, and we started breeding wheat because the growers wanted that, as I said, to add value to a part of their rotation. But there was nowhere for us to test the best uses for these grains. So if we're growing wheat that's sort of out of place, which it is in Skagit Valley, then where is it going to fit? What do we do with it? The notion then was we had nowhere to test it, so we developed a laboratory and called it the Bread Laboratory. And what it is basically is it's a small craft bakery with technical equipment inside of it. So we can work directly with chefs and bakers and millers, and we can mill little batches of flour, and then we can bake it into bread and things like that. And I should say, too, that we work with 100% whole grain products, and we feel that's very important for what we do as well.
Would you highlight the goals of the Bread Lab?
The goals of the Bread Lab are first to make it work for the farmer. And it may sound obvious or almost silly that a plant breeder would put the farmer first, thinking that that's always the case, but actually it's not. So if we are working in a commodity system, who we would be developing varieties for would be the industry as opposed to the grower. And then the grower would grow what was best for industry. If we work for the grower first, and that is our main goal, is to make things work for the farmer, then we can figure out the uses independent of any system after that. So the goal is to develop wheats, barley, beans, buckwheat, rye, various grains that can work for a farmer in conventional or organic systems with the fewest amount of inputs, the best yield within those inputs, and then have some value within the community in terms of flavor or functionality or something like that. So the goals are to make it work for the farmer and keep value as close within the region as is possible. And then it all makes sense after that.
What is your approach to plant breeding? What do you select grains for and what criteria do you use?
So first I should say that we're GMO free. We don't use GMO technologies in our program. And we also strive to make what we do in the public interest, but also available to the public. So we don't lock up things through intellectual property and other techniques. The techniques that we use are the same that were used at our university starting in 1898. So we don't go backwards, but we do value things from the past that have value continuously. So the first wheat breeder was hired at WSU in 1894. The first wheat crosses to develop new varieties were made in 1898. We use the exact same techniques today. We get material from around the world that is still available, and then we see how it does in our environment. And our environment west of the Cascades is quite different than eastern Washington or Kansas or somewhere like that. So we get this material, we see what does well. We talk to the farmers and see what they're looking for, maybe something that's earlier or shorter or whatever it is. And then we make those crosses, get the material going in the field as quickly as we can. And something that we do that's unique as well is we keep variation within a field. So we don't do a strict monoculture. We keep a lot of variation and diversity in the wheat field so that as our climate changes, it can adapt with the environment and with the system that it's in, if that makes sense. So typically wheat is very uniform. As you drive by a wheat field, it all looks the same. The fields that we work with look very different, a lot of variation left in it. So that's basically how we do the breeding. And then I should say, too, that we're informed throughout that process through members of our community and just people that eat things to let us know what they're looking for as well.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Stephen Jones, director of the Washington State University Bread Lab. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. Would you say more about who you collaborate with locally in the Skagit Valley?
I think the first one is we work with the community, and I'll get back to that in just a moment. But there are two flour mills in our valley. One is Fairhaven Organic Flour Mill and then Cairn Springs Mill. So we work with the millers. We work with Skagit Valley Malting, which is a new malt house here. We work with Chuckanut Brewery, Westland Distillery, down in Seattle, Grand Central and Essential and Macrina, and many of the bakeries in the region. We work very directly with those bakers. We work with chefs and restaurants. We start here very locally, and then we get to the region and nationally as well. In working with our community, we think it's important that we have improved access for good food within our community. So we're very interested in bringing price points down in what we do. And that's a good job for a plant breeder, is to increase yield in a meaningful way so that the price can come down for millers or bakers or even serious home bakers, schools. The Skagit Community Foundation bought us a little portable oven so that we could bring it to food banks and shelters and even the public library. So we did a workshop in the public library in November where we had 42 people on a Tuesday night baking bread in among the bookshelves in the Mount Vernon Public Library. So access is availability to basic foods, but it's also knowledge of how to cook and bake again and things like that. So we try to work with as much of our community as we can, both professionally and then in a citizen level as well.
What are some examples of grains specifically adapted to Western Washington that you have helped develop?
We released a new variety of wheat called Skagit 1109, and we're probably going to change the name. It's a little clunky, but that's the first wheat that's been developed, we believe, in the United States in the past 100 years that is designed specifically for whole wheat use. It's never been made into white flour. It's what's called a modern landrace, which means it has a lot of variation left in it. It's one that the bakers and millers really like a lot. We also were involved in getting the variety Edison out to the people. Edison was developed by a retired English professor up at Western Washington University. He did it as sort of a hobby. It's a really nice wheat as well. We're working on making more barleys available. And then something we're really interested in is buckwheat and making that more publicly available. Buckwheat is a tough crop for farmers to get because there's such little research done on it. And most of that research is from the private sector. So it's tough to get. But we'd like to see a new buckwheat coming out soon. Beans, one of our former students, Bridget Mainz, found some beans that do very well here as well, dry beans. So we're trying to get a range, trying to keep variation in our fields, but also on our plates as well.
Would you also comment on the perennial hybrid that you've developed, the Salish Blue?
We've been working on a perennial form of wheat or something similar to wheat since 1995. And being perennials, these are long-term projects. But we have a new one called Salish Blue. It's a blue kerneled wheat. And the notion on a perennial is to reduce the inputs and add a little more back to the environment than we're taking out. So we also named this one as a new species last fall, which we believe has not been done by wheat breeders in this country before. So all wheat breeders develop and release varieties, but it's quite rare to name a totally new species. And we named one Tritopyrum ossii, named in honor of Hannah Ossie, who was a genetics professor at WSU starting in the 20s and then up until the 70s. And she'd basically been forgotten in her science and my science, which is genetics. So we want to honor the work that she did. So the species name of that is Ossii, after Professor Hannah Ossie.
What have been the implications of the Bread Lab's efforts for the local Skagit economy?
Well, we're at the Port of Skagit. We rent at the Port of Skagit, and Patsy Martin, who is the executive director of the Port of Skagit, says that the Bread Lab has contributed to or directly been given credit for creating 200 jobs at the Port of Skagit and within the community in the past few years. And these are good living wage jobs. We think that's important as well. But that's one there. So through new jobs and job creation, but then also within the farming community is adding some value, again, to that sort of downside, not downside in a negative way, but downside economically of their rotation, which would be wheat and barley. So if they can get more for their wheat and barley and not have to truck it down to Portland, that's an economic benefit as well. And then we would hope that there's an environmental benefit of growing wheats and barley and buckwheat and beans and things that do better here. And by better, it means they create more biomass and things that can add more resources back into the soil and make our agriculture a little less extractive.
In what ways are you taking climate change into account in your plant breeding?
We take climate change into account daily in what we do. We're all feeling it, whether we're plant breeders or not. Something's going on, that's for sure. For a plant breeder, it's interesting because one year should predict the next. So if we're developing a new variety of wheat, let's say, and it does really well this year, we would think that it would do well the following year and the following year and the following year. If that's not true, then it makes breeding very complicated and progress less predictable, as well as the climate being less predictable. So one way around that is to create varieties that have more variation and diversity left in them. So a lot of plant breeders take variation out as things go along in generations. We keep it in there, and we think it's very important that if you have a field of wheat and you have thousands of types in there instead of one type, and you have a hot, dry year one year and a cold, wet year the next, or freezing or insect, whatever's causing damage to that crop, by chance it won't affect every individual in that field. And that's one strategy to not combat climate change, but to work with it and have our plants evolve over time within the field. So variation and diversity is the key to working with variation and diversity. So genetic variation in our fields, variation and diversity in terms of what climate we're exposed to, what weather systems are coming through. So we work on that quite often.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Stephen Jones, director of the Washington State University Bread Lab. Would you speak about your collaboration with Chipotle?
So Steve Ells, the founder of Chipotle, came to us, oh, I think it was at least 3 years ago, maybe even more than that. And he said that they had come to a point in their food systems where they had sort of gone through things and cleaned them up, cleaned up their menu, and clean, I mean, by fewer ingredients and how things were treated. So the animals would be not confined and things like that. They got to the flour tortilla, and that's common with other folks that we work with as well, is that they always get to the bread last, right? So you're making a great pizza and you then figure out, well, what flour is going into that crust? Well, same with Chipotle. So their flour tortilla had 12 ingredients in it, and they wanted to reduce those. So working with them, we were able to get that down to 5 ingredients. So to take 7 out, and those 7 were in there to benefit not those of us that are eaters, but those of us that produce that product. One way to look at food labels and ingredients is to ask why those ingredients are in there. And in many cases, in bread, let's say, so bread needs about 4 ingredients. If you have 25 in there, those 21 extra ingredients are not there to make our lives better. They're there to make the manufacturer's life easier and possibly better and more economical. So helpers and preservatives and things like that. So Chipotle had made the point that they wanted to have clean tortillas, clean in quotes, but remove some ingredients. So we were able to do that with them while adding more whole grain to the tortilla itself. What's fascinating is that you can make that decision as a company, but then you also have to agree to make the changes required. How are you going to store these tortillas? Are you going to refrigerate or freeze them? How are they going to be sent to your facility? How often is that going to occur, daily or weekly or what? So the first step in any change for people that we work with is, do they want to do it and do they realize, and that's their decision, of course, not ours, but are they willing to make the changes that would make that possible? And it was successful. They had a press release on that a few months ago. So it just takes a willingness to do it. And in our experience, if you want something to change, it's usually pretty simple, but you might have to change to meet that change that you're asking for, if that makes sense.
How does your collaboration with Chipotle fit with the idea of keeping things local, of keeping value in the Skagit?
So some of the wheat that's going into their flour tortillas comes from here. It's milled at Camas Country Mill in Eugene, Oregon. And that's a good point. And I won't speak for them, but that's where they're attempting to go to, is to regionalize those types of products. They already have it in other parts of their food system, but then in the flour, can they regionalize that? And at least for the Northwest stores, I know that they're putting flour that's grown here regionally and then is milled at Camas Country Mill down in Eugene. It's an issue that we struggle with too in terms of scale and the good parts of scale and maybe the more negative parts of scale that can have on things. And an early one in with Chipotle was they liked the wheat that we suggested and that we worked with so much that they wanted all of it. And then that doesn't work because it pulls out of, in this case, it pulled out of school systems and chefs and bakeries down in the Eugene area, and that did not occur just for that reason, was that there needs to be some give and take there where you don't want to lose your focus of why we're all doing this in the first place. And they were good that way in terms of saying they didn't want to just pull everything out that everyone had worked so hard to get in place. So the notion of scale is quite fascinating. That's where the complications come in, is identifying the positive aspects of it and then agreeing to some pressures that may have unintended consequences. But with this one, it worked fine, where enough of the wheat stayed in the region and it didn't just pull everything out and then left people hanging, sort of.
What do you consider to be the Bread Lab's greatest accomplishment so far?
I think there's probably several, but one is that the farmers in this part of the state no longer use the word commodity. It's very rare. When we first got here, everyone talked about commodities, and we all talk a lot, and we came to the notion that let's talk about food and not commodities, and let's not even use the word agriculture as much as we use the word food. Food is the endpoint, and we use agriculture to get there. And that's somewhat novel or possibly even radical, but just the idea of let's start at the end and describe how we want our food produced, you know, in a way where we could have living wages and a minimal impact on the environment and whatever we're going to look at. But let's talk about food and pull agriculture gently in that direction. So we feel that we're having an impact that way, right? And just switching the conversation a bit to these aren't faceless big gobs of stuff that we're all growing. Its intention is food. And I think that's been a positive for us.
Are there similar efforts to yours at the Bread Lab going on elsewhere?
We work with Drexel University in downtown Philly in one of President Obama's former promise zones to bring food at an urban level and also the peri-urban level around Philadelphia. So helping growers there. We're working on the nutritional delivery of good food in an urban setting. We're also working with Tufts University in Boston on nutritional impact of what we do and how to improve that. We're working with the School of Nutrition and Policy there at Tufts. Again, bringing in local growers, but also complementing what each of us can do. And in that case, bring in just a real high-level School of Nutrition. We have graduate student exchange between those. We work with Nana Meyer, who is at the University of Colorado in Colorado Springs, and she has a really great grain program there in Colorado Springs, and she is also a nutritionist. So those are sort of the academic ones. And then in terms of farming and milling, we work with folks in Vermont and in North Carolina and Arizona and Alaska and down in LA and the Bay Area. So we work primarily in areas that are not considered wheat belt areas or traditional wheat growing areas, because many of these communities had grains and they want to bring those back to their community for economical reasons, but also just for the food sense of what they do. So we're working in quite a few areas. We're also working on the island of Crete in Greece. We work in Europe and other places. So it's quite a movement, and we don't see it as being a trend per se, but just being a readjustment of our food system.
What are your plans for the future and long-term goals?
The long-term goal is, and I should say that we usually don't write these down because if we had, we couldn't certainly predict. I mean, we knew what we wanted to do in general, but very specific goals, they just sort of happen. But I think the idea of nutrition with functionality, and by functionality, I mean the mechanics of making a good loaf of bread and things like that, is can we bring deliciousness more into our food equations? Certainly with something as mundane as wheat. Can we develop these? We can. And then can we use them as a very efficient nutritional delivery mechanism? I know that sounds kind of cold on our plates, but it's a good way to look at it, as we are delivering nutrition in a delicious way. And then in a way that functionally looks appealing and is agreeable to folks. That if we're doing 100% whole wheat croissant or bread, you know, with Macrina or Essential or Grand Central or the Bread Farm up here, whatever bakers we're working with, can we do something that's 100% whole wheat? And people wouldn't just tolerate it, but they'd actually want it. And we're there now. It's just getting more and more folks to realize that a whole grain, they don't have to tolerate it. There's deliciousness there, and there's no excuse for not having one that's very good. So that's what we're striving for, is a more general use of whole grains, I think, is one sort of overarching factor of what we do. And the way to look at that, too, is it's the best use of our land. So Right now, if you're eating white flour, you're only eating 70% of the wheat that was harvested off that. So 100 pounds of wheat makes 70 pounds of white flour. 100 pounds of wheat makes 100 pounds of whole wheat flour. So we see that as the best use of our land, too. It's a nice way to bring it full circle, where you bring in deliciousness and nutritional value and then tie it into the best use of the land. So those are some of the ways we're going, I think.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say eat more wheat is good, or barley or whole grains. I would say don't be afraid of baking. If you used to bake and went away from it, or if you never have, don't put too much pressure on yourself. It's not that difficult to make a good loaf of bread. It doesn't always have to look perfect, but it's going to be economical. It's going to taste good, and you and your friends or family are going to like it. So I would say cook more at home, bake more at home, and just sort of appreciate the beauty that you can find in your food.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much. It was great.
You were just listening to Stephen Jones, director of the Washington State University Bread Lab. For more information, check on the web at thebreadlab.wsu.edu. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to the podcast section of KEXP's website at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at kexp.org.